You're listening to Talking About Glaucoma, bringing the latest advances in glaucoma to eye care providers and patients since 2009. Visit talkingaboutglaucoma.com for more details about each episode. I'm Rob Schertzer, a Vancouver-based glaucoma specialist and educator, and we're Talking About Glaucoma. This episode has been sponsored by Sun Pharma Canada Incorporated. Dr. Mania Madan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Great to have you. And today we're going to talk about glaucoma treatment and how glaucoma medications make dry eyes even worse, and how your approach would be for treating dry eyes and, I guess, improving glaucoma care.
Yeah,
let's begin.
Absolutely.
Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I practice in Vancouver. I split my time between an ophthalmology practice and an optometry practice. And I specialize in kind of working in, in dry eye space, helping patients with moderate to advanced dry eye disease. I also have a lot of patients that I manage medical glaucoma. And of course, they're a dry eye, that can happen with it. I just recently finished my term as the president for BC Doctors of Optometry, so that was a very rewarding position, although I'm looking forward to having some more free time now, as it was a very busy time.
Awesome.
And this is a topic I'm really, really passionate about, right? Because I think, dry eye and glaucoma, especially in terms of being an optometrist, are two conditions we're very, very able to manage and have a big impact on patients' quality of life. Now, when we talk about...
Yeah, as an ophthalmologist, we've spent decades really wrecking the ocular surface with so many medications. And a lot of times, just, if the glaucoma is poorly controlled, you're just adding more medications. The sole goal there is getting the pressure down. And patients aren't always taking those medications because they bother them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of the challenge, right? There was actually a survey study that I read actually from 2002, which mentioned, I don't know if you saw this, Dr. Schertzer, that there's 56,000 ways to manage glaucoma. And this was over 20 years ago, with the combination of medications and surgeries and monotherapy and, multiple medications. The combinations that they can put together. I mean, there's 56,000 ways to manage glaucoma. Pretty astounding. And, and today with all of the other new surgeries like MIGS and drops that we have available, I mean, I'm sure that number is really, really high, right? And I think what that reminds me of that again is that glaucoma is not just an exact science. So managing glaucoma isn't just an exact science. But there is a bit of an art to it. Not only, of course, do we have to diagnose glaucoma, we, of course, have to get the patient's pressure down, but it's also looking at, coming up with a tailored treatment plan for them that they're going to be able to adhere to, looking at those side effects, looking at the cost, and then ultimately, again, either preserving their quality of life or improving. And unfortunately, a lot of glaucoma medications, like you said, can really tank their quality of life, right? And so one might say, well, we've got their pressure down, right? But is that enough if their eyes are irritated, red, and they can't do the things that they used to do, and they're anxious and depressed? Like, have we really managed a condition of, while kind of creating another one?
And also with that too, it's not just about pressure. The pressure just has to be low enough to not have them continue to progress. So many times patients are overtreated, or they're treated for ocular hypertension and they've never progressed, and perhaps they shouldn't have even been treated in the first place.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That's a whole other, that's one of the other 56,000 pathways of treatment, I guess.
Oh, for sure. And that's exactly true, right? There's undertreatment and there's overtreatment. And it's finding that fine balance of, well, how are we going to be just right at this? And then of course, when we talk about dry eye, and I think you and I hear a lot about it, especially in the last 10 years or so, but some of the statistics around it are really astounding too. There's another stat that I recently read that there are 3.7 billion searches on Google every single day on the word dry eye. Yeah. Right? Wow. 3.7 billion searches. That's over 40,000 searches per second on the word dry eye. I mean, this is definitely a condition that's on top of mind for a lot of our patients. And in terms of ophthalmic conditions, dry eye tends to cause, has the highest link with depression and anxiety. In fact, followed by glaucoma, but dry eye is still high up there.
Yeah. No, I have a patient absolutely miserable. He's wearing goggles for his dry eyes and has tried everything there is. And it's really affected his life.
Exactly. And those are the patients that I often end up seeing in my practice as well. They've been treated for glaucoma for many years. And then now it's just that, the ocular surface was completely missed. And of course, now they're very, very miserable. And I think, it is important to kind of talk about the drops that some of our patients are on. I remember when I graduated from school, prostaglandins had just come out. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, still very young. But, and I remember hearing, you got to tell your patients that they're going to have longer eyelashes and they're going to get some darkening of the iris. But that was really all, right? And I think since then we've learned that is far more than just that. I mean, a lot of these glaucoma medications can cause damage to the goblet cells. They can cause punctate keratopathy, toxicity to corneal nerves, which is huge. And when I actually look at some of the studies for neurotrophic keratitis, right, you can see that, of course, some of the major causes of NK are herpetic eye diseases, but glaucoma medications is up there too. And that was, very alarming to me. And then, of course, conjunctival inflammation, you can also get from these glaucoma medications. We know that glaucoma is not a sprint, right? It is a marathon. And so now we're putting on things that are going to be maybe even make them unsuccessful at tubes and shunts later on if they should ever need it. So lots of big concerns around these glaucoma medications. And of course, there's a ton of MGD that I see in my practice. Meibomian gland dropout, blepharitis, and then eyelid abnormalities. I mean, their eyelids look, red and irritated and inflamed. So not even like, not just functionality, but even cosmesis. I mean, that can really, cause a big impact on how they feel.
Is there proof that the glaucoma medications themselves can cause the meibomian gland dysfunction?
Yeah, absolutely. There are actually a plethora of studies out there that prove that it's not just the BAK in the medications, but the medications themselves can be neurotoxic to the corneal surface. Yeah, are you finding that in your practice too?
Well, it's hard to tell because the majority of my patients are glaucoma patients, and so many of them have meibomian gland dysfunction that I guess I look at it more and more carefully in the past year or two. If you don't look, you're not going to find it. And you look and you see those bulging meibomian gland orifices or these white tracks leading from the meibomian glands, extending the full length of the lids from the plugged up glands. And I don't know if it's something that I just wasn't noticing as much before. So as an initial approach of the 56,000 approaches for glaucoma, I've definitely been doing SLT as my first line for a long time, for at least 15 years, whereas we finally have proof for that. If you want to mention the light trial.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that light trial was, really a pivotal trial, and that was very robust in telling us that not only as first-line treatment for ocular hypertension and primary open-angle glaucoma, not only did it provide more robust IOP lowering, it was more cost-effective and definitely patients experienced less side effects. And so when we look at it, I think it really is a no-brainer that we should be offering this to our patients as first-line therapy, and then minimizing and saving their ocular surface should they ever need, glaucoma therapy in the future. I actually wanted to ask you a few more questions about the light trial, just from your perspective too. It was interesting as I read that study, they also showed that they actually repeated SLT at 8 weeks, right? And how often would you say, and I think there's some confusion around that too, right? We want to know what are patients that are going to be really good to do SLT on. They're going to respond well. And then mm-hmm. how often can we repeat it? And I'm really kind of fascinated with some of the data that's coming out around that. But yeah, the SLT trial alluded that, you know, they actually repeated SLT at 8 weeks. How do you find in your practice?
Now, I find an initial treatment, it's variable, of course, like 80 to 85% of patients respond mm-hmm. to the treatment. So 15 to 20 don't respond at all, which is similar to starting them on any yeah. medication. And then if it's effective, I don't repeat it. I don't repeat it until the effect seems to be mm-hmm. wearing off. And when I get to that point, it could be 6 months, it could be a year, it could be mm-hmm. 5 years mm-hmm. later. Then I offer them repeating the SLT or starting them on medications. And we've only had studies that show repeating the treatment two more times, so mm-hmm. three treatments as being effective, but that's just because no study was done beyond three treatments. So I do have the rare patient where I've treated four or five or even six times over 15 mm-hmm. years. But most of the patients are lasting quite a long time just with one treatment. Yeah. So I don't know why 8 week repeat
necessary.
Would be
we're not. I think
I never like over treating yeah. anything when it comes to meds or with
yeah. I think it was one of the
or with surgery just the treatment that's needed to get to your
yeah goal. No, for sure. I think it was one of the arms of the study where, you know, if they didn't initially respond to it, they were repeated at 8 weeks to see. And then what they found was that there was a 44% chance that one SLT was going to last at least 6 years. So that's actually pretty great. That's exactly what you're kind of saying too. There was another study that I kind of read that was coming out of Italy where they are doing repeated annual SLTs, and they've got a 10-year data, and it's like a low energy SLT, and they're repeating it on patients every year. And that is kind of showing that these patients are again stable with their glaucoma and not needing medication. So kind of interesting, all of this, right? And how that's going to change and how we manage glaucoma again.
Yeah, I didn't see that study. Did they have an arm where they weren't treating them every year and see if it really makes
yes,
a difference?
Exactly. Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think SLT again is a really great option. There is also this another great survey that was done by Boudain, who's done a lot of work in the dry eye space, particularly that vicious cycle of dry eye. And he had surveyed, or in this study, they surveyed 9,600 patients, so nearly 10,000 patients, and using preserved glaucoma medications versus using, you know, and then changed them to using non-preserved. And just that little change made such an impact on the patient, right? So even if you're keeping a patient on glaucoma medications, right, just getting rid of that BAK can make such a profound difference. And so they noted reduced redness, reduced irritation, foreign body sensation, and all of these other, you know, wonderful, wonderful things that our patients don't like experiencing. So something as simple as just going to a non-preserved drop, I think, can make a big difference. Unfortunately, I do find many of our patients are still on preserved drops, even though, you know, we know so much about this, and it is a simple change. Yeah.
Right. Some of that is practitioner knowledge, and some of it is cost issues too, because not all of the non-preserved formulations are covered as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, and a lot of these studies are out of the United States too, right? And of course, their formulary drugs and insurance things are, I feel like, much bigger over there than they are here. I think our patients can still access things at a decent cost, perhaps, where it's very insurance driven in the United States. And so I feel like the practitioners are kind of tied, right?
Right. Yeah, you've been on both sides of the border too for practicing. So you've seen how much more expensive a lot of the medications are in the States. Like patients having to pay like $300 for their bottle of a glaucoma medication. That might be $20 here.
I mean, it's insane. It's really insane. Yeah. So, I mean, in my practice, again, so managing, you know, a dry eye with glaucoma is really a big overlap, right? I think one of the easiest things we can do, especially in a busy practice and we're seeing a lot of glaucoma patients, is one of the first things I would recommend starting with is just a questionnaire, right? There are so many great questionnaires out there, like the OSDI score or the CDA or the DQ5. Mm-hmm. As the patient's waiting in the exam room, the waiting area, just having them look at that survey can start to open up some conversations, and you can talk to them about it when you see the results of those surveys. And I don't think it has to take a lot of time, right? And I think that's the other thing is, I mean, there's so many things to talk about, especially when you're just managing glaucoma. If I have to tell my patient about SLT or drops, there's only so much time in your exam room. So having a survey that I could quickly see how much impact it's having on them, that, you know, their dry eye, can really quickly tell me which way I'm going to shift in my when they're finally in my exam chair. So I find that I find that a really valuable and easy tool, right? I have my pretesters always give that survey to the patients as they're waiting. And then when I see the patient, of course, in my exam chair, like you said, you really do have to look. And dry eye testing doesn't have to be expensive. All you really need to do is put a stain on the surface of the eye, right? And that's going to give you such quick information on the tear breakup time, any punctate keratopathy, you know, their tear volume, and it's a very quick snapshot. As we're evaluating the visual fields, the OCTs, I mean, of course, there's a ton going on here. And then I'll, quickly press on their eyelids, have them look down, look for the presence of blepharitis, and like you said, pull the lid down a little bit, right? So these are, again, quick tests to do. And I think...
I'd say so many of my patients, again, maybe it's the selection bias, but you don't even have to stain the tear film because you just look and there is no tear film.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's...
So maybe if I was doing a survey, I'd get more information about those who are less, have less extreme dry eyes that I'm definitely missing.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. And I think catching them at that point, right, is going to make all of our lives so much easier as we move forward. And that's an inexpensive way, and I feel like it adds a lot of value, and patients feel acknowledged too, that they were coming in with something and that was kind of heard and looked at.
What's your approach with starting them on treatment? Do you start with over-the-counter non-preserved drops, or do you move right away into the products that you could only buy from an eye care provider, or do you go right on into cyclosporine?
Yeah, I feel like I tend to be definitely a little bit more aggressive in managing dry eye in my patients with glaucoma, right? Just because I know that glaucoma treatment causes dry eye, right? And dry eye in itself is so common and can have a big impact. So I tend to really move away from just over-the-counter stuff. If I'm already seeing signs and they've got some symptoms, it really is time to move on and do something else. And I think it's also important to realize that by the time patient actually presents to you and says something, they've actually been trying things at home for good 5-6 years. You know, they've been listening to their neighbor. They've been listening to some TikTok video talking about some dry eye product to help manage their dry eyes. And if they come into your chair and all you're saying is, well, go back out there again and try another plethora of over-the-counter, I just don't think that's a good use of anybody's time as the disease is progressing and it's not being managed, right?
Yes, and they're still using their home remedy of some tea bags on their eyes.
Exactly. There's so much these patients are doing by the time they've come to you. So my first kind of line of therapy is to actually start them on a medication that is going to manage the root cause of dry eye, which is inflammation. So I do turn to cyclosporins or lifitografts, right off the bat with these patients. Sequoia Restasis and Xiidra is what we have approved here. And it's just so important, to manage that. I mean, I always explain to the patients, I mean, your tear film is far so specialized. There's nothing over the counter that's going to replace your own natural tear film, right? All those things are going to provide or some symptomatic relief, but not get to the root cause.
Right.
And unless we manage the root cause, the disease is going to keep progressing. And so my, initial therapies are going to be prescription medications for these patients. And then, of course, lid hygiene. I think that's such a big component in glaucoma that's missed, because a lot of these glaucoma medications do cause, you know, eyelid abnormalities and increase their prevalence of blepharitis. So managing the blepharitis properly and then starting them on a anti-inflammatory, I think, can go a long way.
Right. So I guess a couple of things we could talk about from there. One is the difference between the two different cyclosporine formulations we have, the Restasis versus the Cequa. And the other is the treatment of, in terms of lid care and why patients should not be using baby shampoo.
Yeah, let's talk about baby shampoo first, right? Because I think that's definitely something, apologies. Oh my God, my voice, sorry.
So I know baby shampoo is a pet peeve of yours for treatment.
Oh my goodness. So that was, you know, recommended back in the 70s. And I think it was in the Will's Eye Manual back then, right? But we've grown and learned so much more since then. The microflora that grows on the lids, the microbiome, is not susceptible to baby shampoo. And it actually immobilizes.
Yeah. It's not just staph epidermidis, which is what they were talking about then. Now it's a whole multiple different organisms living in a happy ecosystem.
Exactly. Exactly. And it only just emulsifies the, you know, the fatty oils that we do want on the lid margin. And so really is not an effective treatment. And we definitely have some more effective treatments for the blepharitis management. So that's a really important message that I think we got to stop telling our patients to do is clean their lids with baby shampoo. They're not a baby. They don't need baby shampoo. And then in terms of the cyclosporins, you know, Restasis has been around for a very long time. It's the low dose cyclosporin, plus it's in a different vehicle than Cequa is. I do find better results with Cequa, and maybe it's because of the nanomicellar technology. It has better absorption into the ocular surface. And, you know, patients, you know, tend to find results with it a little bit sooner. And again, sometimes I'll explain it to patients as in, you know, it's like upgrading to a new technology, right? You've got an iPhone from, I don't know, 2005, and now you've got an iPhone from 2024. There's going to be a difference. And I think some of the studies do allude to that too, that patients do better on Cequa versus Restasis. How are you finding that?
Yeah, I still have a number of patients who are on Restasis for many years, but lately it's been more Cequa prescriptions, and they both seem to be happy. Mm-hmm. And you can still have patients who aren't responding to either of those, but I guess that leads to the next stage of things, IPL and radiotherapy options, because it's not just the surface disease, it's the meibomian glands being plugged up.
Exactly.
So I don't know if you want to talk
about that. Yeah, absolutely. Once if the patients are kind of not responding to some of those therapies, that, you know, I think it is important to kind of move on to some of the other in-office therapies to help with their meibomian gland dysfunction. I mean, IPL, you know, does have a lot of evidence now. It's borrowed, obviously, from the dermatology space for the management of rosacea. But we also know that in terms of ocular rosacea, meibomian gland dysfunction, and Demodex on the eyelid, IPL can be quite powerful as a photobiomodulation and reducing inflammation on the eyelids. You know, so that is something patients do find a lot of relief with. And it's also something nice that they don't have to do at home, right? I mean, lid care, you know, using drops at home, that is hard. If anybody's ever tried putting drops in more than 2 to 4 times a day, that's a lot of work. And I think compliance is an issue too. So there's definitely those patients that will benefit from some of these in-office therapies, especially if their condition's not managed and if compliance is something that they're not able to do.
Do you have a rough idea of how accessible these treatments are in BC and in Canada and the United States? And maybe
absolutely. You know, more probably in BC, Canada, and United States. I think we are seeing definitely more practitioners starting to manage dry eye disease, not just optometrists, but ophthalmologists as well, that are now investing into some of these machines like the radio frequency, or is it the Lippi Flow, to have an in-office option for these patients. So I definitely do think that it is increasing. It is an area where, you know, you really kind of want to spend a little bit of time if you're going to invest in a machine to, you know, do this. Like anything, right? Any addition to your practice, you've got to be pretty invested in how am I going to talk to my patients about it? How is my staff going to talk to my patients about it? And how is this going to be incorporated into the whole practice flow? And once we kind of figure out those logistics, right, I think all of these technologies can be very beneficial to the patient. It's nice to have options, right? We are kind of now living in that era where I think optometry, ophthalmology, it is so exciting because there are so many ways we can now manage some of these things, more than 56,000.
Right. And there are ways of working together. It's not a competition. We're all after improving the care for our patients.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really key message too. I mean, I spent about 10 years in the United States before moving back to Canada. And the collaborative approach where ophthalmologists and optometrists work together to manage a patient is such a beneficial system. I often see patients referred from ophthalmologists to manage their dry eye, and just having that open conversation, you know, together, hey, you know, this is what's happening with their glaucoma and this is what's happening with their dry eye. Because like you said, it's so difficult to talk about all of these conditions at the same visit, right? And there's a lot of questions and we don't want to glance over or glaze over, this is not important or this is not important. We want to make sure patients are acknowledged and feel like there is good quality of care. Not only is that important for patient satisfaction, but I think you drive a lot of career satisfaction when we're making a good impact on a patient's quality of life. So I think if we worked well together, right, and I think that could be beneficial, not just as a personal, professional growth, but also for the patient as well.
Maybe our common background in having both worked in the States is why we're both in practice situations now where we're working together with optometrists and ophthalmologists under the same roof.
Absolutely.
You at least part-time and me now full-time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, so, you know, when I moved to Canada about 10 years ago, that was not very common here at all. And I remember approaching many ophthalmologists and saying, hey, this was my experience at Minnesota Eye Consultants, or, you know, some of these great big ophthalmology clinics or Eye Center of Texas. And I think we can do something really great together. I think patients will benefit. And it was not something that was taken well initially, but, you know, I'm grateful to be in a practice where both of us see the benefit of this. And I think patients win. Patients win at the end for sure. And that's what makes it such a satisfying career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just so the audience knows, we're not in practice together. We're in different practices.
That's right.
So while we covered a lot of ground here, but I don't know if I diverted you away from anything that you had in mind that you wanted to cover, because we just sort of followed the flow of the conversation. Is any other comments you want to make or things that we left out?
No, I think we did. I think we did pretty well. I think we, you know, talked about the importance of kind of managing both of those conditions together. Either we do it in our practices or we refer to a colleague, and we got to lean on each other, right? To be able to have, it takes a village to raise your children, right? It really takes a village to manage some of these patients, and it's so important to kind of have that.
Yeah, cool. So where can our listeners find you online?
Well, you can find me on social media, as Dr. Scherzer knows. I do like posting some silly videos about dry eye on social media. So my tag on all of them across the board, Instagram, LinkedIn, is dr.mania.madan. So that's Dr. Mania Madan. And then, of course, you can also find me on my website, which is vancouvereyedoctor.ca. And I love connecting with people, very cool. So please do reach out. I love having that village and that community where we can, you know, just, it's like ask a friend a question.
Very cool. Thanks so much for being on the show. Mani and Badan.
Thank you.
This episode has been sponsored by Sun Pharma Canada Incorporated. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. Visit talkingaboutglaucoma.com for more details about each episode and how to get more involved with the show, including receiving future newsletters or becoming a guest or sponsor. Please rate the show on your podcast player of choice and tell your friends about it. Keep informed to prevent needless loss of vision from glaucoma. See you next time on Talking About Glaucoma.